The decision which has been taken in accordance with our European policy is to suspend the AstraZeneca vaccine as a precautionary measure, with hopes of resuming distribution as soon as the European Medicines Agency allows it. We are led here by a simple guide, informed by science and the relevant authorities, also doing so within the framework of a European strategy.
French President Emmanuel Macron yesterday announcing his country would not use AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine for the time being, after reports surfaced of blood clots in some recipients. Germany, Italy, and Spain followed suit. The drug maker, the World Health Organization, and that same European regulator Macron mentioned all say there is no evidence of a link between the blood clots and the vaccine. The UK is still administering the AstraZeneca shot. The vaccine is still awaiting approval here in the United States. So how concerned should we be about all this? Let's ask Dr. Edward Jones Lopez from USC's Keck School of Medicine. He's one of the investigators on USC's trial of the AstraZeneca vaccine. Welcome back to Press Play.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, what do you make of this reaction on the part of all these countries in Europe to halt, suspend, at least temporarily, the use of the AstraZeneca vaccine?
Yeah, so interesting. I and others are a bit perplexed about it. It's not clear to me entirely what is behind this. As you mentioned, the evidence supporting this decision is actually on the weak side. The association of clots with vaccine, apparently, I was reading about it myself, has been reported in about 30 patients in all of the European Union. And so that is a relatively small number when compared to the expected number, particularly when you think of clots. I mean, particularly when you think of the populations that are getting this vaccine, you know, that are typically older individuals with a series of slew of other of comorbidities, no? So our increased risk of clots, no? So I think...
Oh, so it's possible they could have developed the clots independently of the vaccine, that it's
exactly,
just
exactly.
Associative.
That is obviously what needs to be asked. What is the background clot formation in a population that is similar? The important things to consider here is that in the vaccine trials, and there's several of them have been published that are behind the approval of this particular vaccine in Europe or in the UK, at least in other countries, by the way, there was no signal of increased clots or anything else. Actually, the safety signals for all of these vaccines that are now in emergency use approval are actually extremely low, less than 1%, with side effects that are considered serious. No? And AstraZeneca is not different than any of the other vaccines to date. Now, in the background behind this, there is a need to be very vigilant about vaccines, particularly these new vaccines, because they're still investigational by nature. No? So there is some, I would say, there is some reason to always be very vigilant about particularly safety-related signals. But based on the data that is available, there's really nothing that distinguishes this particular potential side effect from other, from other vaccines or even a clear association with this vaccine.
Well, when you say you need to be vigilant for possible safety problems, does that not reinforce the idea among some vaccine skeptics that they should wait and see to see how the vaccine plays out and not jump to get it?
So, yes, and that's a fine line. So, I mean, if we remember how vaccines are studied and proven to be both safe and effective, it really goes through very exhaustive, protocols that include several animal models in the very, very beginning, even before jumping into phase one human trials. And then once that is done, you go into phase two human trials, and then phase three, which are the phase, the studies that are being published and conducted as we speak, and that lead to the approval of the vaccine. Yeah? But all of these phase two trials are basically designed for two-year follow-up. And the two-year follow-up is particularly, planned to detect very rare or long-term safety side effects, and we are not quite there yet. Some of these vaccines, for example, the Pfizer, the Moderna, and now the Johnson & Johnson, the three that have been approved in the U.S., we now have about 6 to 8 months of follow-up. So the two-year period of follow-up has not been completed. But in none of the data that we have, and now we have to consider also another data point, which is that these early approved vaccines now have been given in the tens of millions of doses, which is a different way to get to the same issue, which is to detect very rare side effects that are significant. Yeah. So right now, the signals are safety signals, are somewhat incomplete in terms of length of follow-up, but there is absolutely nothing to be of concern. In the contrary, actually, this efficacy data that is accompanying those safety data is so good that, you know, there's very clear indication from a medical standpoint, from a public health standpoint, to vaccinate as many as many people as possible.
Right. So we just learned this week that here in San Bernardino County, someone, the first Californian that we know of, has tested positive for the Brazilian variant. Mm-hmm. How concerned are you about that, and how effective are the existing vaccines that we have, the Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson vaccines? How effective are they against this particular variant?
Yeah, so that's on the other side, the more concerning observation that we have, which is that not only the AstraZeneca vaccine that is making a lot of news because of that, and because of its lack of efficacy against these new variants, but all the other vaccines, the Johnson & Johnson, for example, showed that the difference in efficacy between South Africa, for example, and the U.S. was a good 10 percentage points, you know, around 62, 64. To around 72%, you know, and that is probably because in South Africa they have a variant that is escaping the immunity that is generated by these vaccines. Yeah, in the case of Pfizer and Moderna, it just happens that they were developed the earliest. They started their studies in June and July of last year, and by the time they completed their phase 3 studies, the relative proportion of these variants was lower, at least in the places where they studied the vaccine. But there's now some immunological data, blood-based data, that is not quite the same as efficacy data, but it's informative, that suggests that even these very, very efficacious vaccines, which are Pfizer and Moderna, may be a little less efficacious against these variants. No? And yeah. So the solution for this issue, which is a real issue, and there's several variants, the one in the UK, the one in South Africa, the one in Brazil, and then there's more variants that are going to be discovered and reported. And the solution to this is really twofold. One is to augment and accelerate vaccination to really close the door for the virus to continue transmitting and replicating. This is how these variants emerge. Mm-hmm. And then the second strategy that is also being followed is these companies working on new versions of the vaccines that would include, specifically targets against these variants. No? So
the
combination
of boosters.
Exactly, those two vaccines that are being discussed. You know?
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on.
Okay, my pleasure, and thanks for inviting me again.
My pleasure. Dr. Edward Jones Lopez from USC's Keck School of Medicine. Okay, more now on why the European Union's vaccine rollout has been going so slowly compared to other nations, wealthy nations. In Germany, France, Spain, and Italy, fewer than 4% of people in those countries are fully vaccinated, and that's compared to about 12% here in the United States. Here to talk about what's going wrong is Dave Lawler, World News Editor for Axios. Hi, Dave.
Hi, great to be with you.
All right, well, let's talk about the suspension of the AstraZeneca vaccine first, and we just spoke about that. And Dr. Edward Jones-Lopez says that this is an overreaction on the part of EU leaders. He doesn't really understand why this is happening, given the scant evidence. So politically, why is this happening?
Yeah, so there's a backstory here when it comes to Europe and this particular vaccine, the AstraZeneca vaccine. The initial controversy was over supply of this vaccine, which is it was produced in the UK. It's been used quite widely there, but in the European Union, supply was coming much more slowly than had been anticipated, and that was causing the rollout at large to be a little bit slower than they'd wanted. So there was some anger there about a slow supply from AstraZeneca. Then sort of the next phase of this were questions about how effective it was. There was some erroneous reporting that this vaccine was not all that effective. It was not initially approved for people over 65, so the doses just weren't being used to a certain degree. And now we have this new phase where actually the data that was coming in, as the doctor in the previous segment noted, the data has actually looked increasingly good about how effective this vaccine is. But now we have this blood clot issue that originally popped up in Scandinavia and then yesterday caused sort of the big, most populous countries in the EU to shut down distribution temporarily. So it's been a long saga when it comes to the EU and AstraZeneca. And this is the latest and most dramatic sort of phase of that, I would say.
And are they using any other vaccines or is it primarily AstraZeneca?
Pfizer is the other major one. And so there's been a split actually in some of these countries. People would prefer to get the Pfizer vaccine because of some of the doubts that have been raised, many of them not based in facts, but some of the doubts that have been raised about the AstraZeneca vaccine. But the Pfizer take up of the Pfizer vaccine has been higher than of the AstraZeneca vaccine.
Some vaccine skepticism there that is preventing them not only from taking the AstraZeneca, but also the Pfizer vaccine. I know the authorities have been slow to roll out the vaccines in general, but has there been reluctance to take them once they are rolled out?
There has. And when we talk about the AstraZeneca vaccine, I think that is another worry here about the suspension of this vaccine. Is that going to make people think twice about being vaccinated when it starts being rolled back out? But yes, before this whole thing happened, we were already seeing data from Europe that in some cases, countries were even more, there was even more widespread vaccine skepticism than we've seen here in the United States. France, for example, the percentage of people who say they will get a vaccine once they're eligible is relatively low. It's higher in other countries. The UK has really embraced the national vaccine drive. But yes, European countries are facing a lot of the same challenges that we are here in the US when it comes to vaccine hesitancy.
And is it based in similar reasoning? Is it based, a lot of it here is based on political fault lines. Is it the same there?
Yeah, there are political aspects to it. There's a history of vaccine hesitancy in France in particular that predated this COVID rollout. You know, I'm sure there's a confluence of factors there. Disinformation is another thing. We're all living in sort of the same social media universe and people are seeing a lot of the same information. And so, yes, I think there, you know, you could probably point to a lot of the same root causes in European countries that you would here in the U.S.
Okay, so meanwhile, we see Italy shutting down again. And politically, what's the reaction to that?
Yeah, so this is it's quite a rough patch for the EU when you consider you have a very slow vaccine rollout at the same time as you have a third wave of the virus there. Italy in particular is seeing a spike in cases and has just announced a new lockdown, region by region lockdown. But this is, you'll remember, just about a year after Italy became the first Western country to lock down in the previous, in sort of the first wave. And there were quite prolonged lockdowns in Europe. A lot of countries hoped that the lockdown period was behind them. But we are seeing this surge in cases driven by variants in large part. And in Italy's case, it's this British variant, the UK variant. And there are some concerns that we could see a similar phenomenon in the U.S., but it's really a race between vaccinations and variants at this point, and we're in a much better place on the vaccine front than Europe is right now.
I wonder what they're saying in Britain regarding the EU and the lack of a widespread vaccination success there, they have had better success in Britain. And whether or not that feeds into any, I guess, reconsideration over Brexit, whether it was a good idea or not to leave the EU.
Yeah, certainly, if you ask somebody who supported Brexit and they're looking at these vaccine numbers, they might say, hey, this is pretty good. We broke away from this kind of slower communal process that we see in Brussels, and we're doing it our own way, and it's going faster. There's a particular issue when it comes to the AstraZeneca vaccine, which, as I mentioned, was developed at Oxford University. It's a British, it's a homegrown vaccine. There's a lot of pride in the UK at this the fact that that vaccine is going all over the world and has powered quite a quick rollout in the UK. And so some of the skepticism in Europe, people in the UK, certainly there have been politicians who've kind of chimed in saying that this is jealousy from the EU. This is, kind of a post-Brexit animosity thing, that they're being skeptical of our vaccine. We thought Brexit was over, but it's never really over. And it's cropped up again in the in sort of the vaccine rollout.
And note again that Britain has not suspended the AstraZeneca vaccine.
Right. And they've, as you mentioned, they've actually been even a little bit quicker than the U.S. in terms of relative to their population, how many doses they've distributed. And that's based heavily around this AstraZeneca vaccine.
Dave, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Dave Lawler, he is world news editor for Axios. Coming up, what Facebook is doing to combat anti-vaccination messages on its website. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We talked about vaccine skepticism earlier. Well, a lot of the false information that can fuel this mistrust is spread on Facebook. For years, the social media site has been a big platform for the anti-vax movement, and that's only increased with the arrival of the COVID vaccines. Well, Facebook says it wants to do better now. CEO Mark Zuckerberg announced a plan yesterday to help 50 million people get vaccinated. He says Facebook will create a tool to help people find vaccination appointments at local sites. And he says Facebook will fight misinformation on its platform. Here with more is Ronnie Mola, senior data reporter for Recode. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Madeline.
Well, it's great to have you. Well, so this is a longstanding issue for Facebook. It obviously goes beyond COVID-19 and into election year politics, for example. Facebook just doesn't want to police its users. So why is Mark Zuckerberg suddenly changing the policies and waging a campaign against vaccine misinformation?
I think part of it has to do with vaccines just becoming at the forefront of our public health crisis right now. I mean, vaccines obviously were always an issue, but it was seen as more of a sort of fringe thing. You know, some people, a lot of people on Facebook groups would share misinformation, would, you know, sort of encourage themselves not to be vaccinated. And that's, you know, had a long-standing platform on Facebook. But now that, you know, the whole world is in this pandemic and a giant health crisis, and the vaccine seems to be our only way out, it's like, you know, it's really forced the issue. So it's a much bigger deal to have an anti-vax movement on your social media platform now than it was, you know, 10 years ago.
Right. From a public health perspective, for sure.
Sure.
And so I know that Mark Zuckerberg, he has a hospital named after him and his wife in San Francisco. He's interested in healthcare issues.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's interesting because obviously, as we said, this sort of stuff has flourished on the platform. But, he's also doing a bunch of things, you know, with Facebook to try to get people vaccinated. As you said, he wants to get 50 million people vaccinated. They're making it so that it's much easier to do through Facebook. You could talk to chatbots on WhatsApp to help you get registered. There's stickers on Instagram that'll help encourage people. You know, you share this and you say, I got vaccinated. It wasn't bad. I'm okay. You know, this is a safe thing. And then also a lot of just combating misinformation. Back in February, they announced that, you know, they're going to actually take down misinformation about the coronavirus vaccine. And in this latest announcement, they said they would actually slow the distribution from people who normally post this sort of stuff. Like if you've had a history of posting anti-vax stuff or stuff that's been fact checked and debunked, they're going to make it harder for your message to get around.
So how is he going to go about moderating this content? Because I can see that it could slip into a gray area. Maybe people are having a conversation with their friends in a group or what have you, and they're just wondering whether the vaccine is safe, or they're discussing the side effects, which they might be worried about, or I don't know, all sorts of stuff that can be interpreted as a negative vaccine message, but more subtle than, you know, vaccines are a government plot.
Right. So I talked with a few experts about this. And, you know, if someone says something like, I think vaccines are bad, that's not going to be taken down because that's not misinformation. That's an opinion. But Facebook's own internal report, according to a Washington Post article earlier this week, said that, you know, they were very aware that a lot of the vaccine skepticism on the site was being spread by these posts that weren't really misinformation. You know, they weren't, you know, saying this is a government plot to put chips in your brain. They were saying, I think it's against my belief system, or I think they're bad, something that wouldn't necessarily get flagged. And the problem, according to the experts, with, you know, Facebook just sort of waging this information campaign, when you post something about coronavirus, a label will pop up and say, here's, you know, real information about this. It's not the same thing as these sort of sophisticated arguments that are happening on Facebook by anti-vax people who are trying any number of tactics to get people not to be vaccinated. You know, you have to kind of fight fire with fire. You have to sort of meet people where they are to, you know, see what their specific concerns are and talk about those, not just simply say, hey, here's a, you know, a nutrition label, or here are the real facts. You kind of have to have that same sort of sophisticated argument to these groups of people who are vaccine hesitant.
So how is Facebook going to enable that?
Oh, since early in the pandemic, they've partnered with the Delphi Group, which is this epidemiological study group that has normally tracked the flu. They're at Carnegie Mellon University, and Facebook has allowed them to take surveys, something like 50,000 surveys on Facebook a day, and they go straight to this research group. And, you know, this is one of those prongs of where Mark Zuckerberg is doing something that's really in the public good as far as vaccines are concerned, and they've been doing this for a long time. And that group has been able to figure out, okay, what are the reasons why these certain vaccine hesitant groups are saying they're not going to do it? And they found a whole host of different reasons based on where you live, based on your demographic group, whether you're Black, white, Latinx. There's many different reasons why people are saying, hey, I don't want to get this, or I'm hesitant to get this. And the purpose of all the study is to get a public health response that is tailored to these specific concerns, as opposed to saying, hey, you're just dumb, listen, this is right. Mm-hmm. You know, like meeting them on their own turf.
But one of the reasons appears to be political. A new survey finds that half of all Republican men say they don't want to get it, at least not right now. So how does Facebook attack that angle of it?
Well, one of the researchers I talked to, the professor at George Washington University, was saying that, you know, you really, as I said before, you really have to target these specific groups. And the survey you're referring to is the NPR Marist poll that said that Trump supporters and Republicans were the group that was most likely to say that they're hesitant to get a vaccine. They wouldn't get it if you told them to. So, like, I guess it's just reaching out to those specific groups, seeing why they feel the way they do, and, you know, maybe having their own politicians say this is why. From that epidemiological survey I was talking about before, the information source that people were most likely to listen to was their local health providers, and, you know, more than politicians, more than, you know, the TV and any sort of source. This is the person they trust. So I guess it's a matter of having your doctors, your local doctor, say so.
Right. So it's been a day since they've made this announcement. Any sign of success so far?
I also spoke with another Facebook critic who was like, Facebook announced in February that they were going to take a bunch of misinformation about vaccines that had been on the site forever down, and a whole bunch of it's still up. So, you know, it's difficult to parse how much of this is a PR move versus how much of this is like a really, you know, truthful attempt to try to make things better on the site. So it seems like even since last month, those promises that they've made haven't necessarily been fulfilled. So there's that.
There's that. Ronnie Mulla, senior data reporter for Recode. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, as schools open back up, Asian American students are more reluctant to return. One reason? Discrimination.
A woman brought her child on the subway to school, and she was harassed on the train. And after that, she decided to keep her daughter home. She was afraid to ride the subway.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, LAUSD is aiming to get kids and teachers back in the classroom next month. But if and when that happens, about half of the students say they're not going to be there. That's according to early results of a parent survey the district released yesterday. It showed a lot of parents, especially those living in areas hard hit by the virus, are reluctant to send their kids back. Around the country, where schools are already open, a growing number of Asian American families chose to continue remote learning. There are several reasons for that, but the main one is fear of being targeted. There's been an increase in anti-Asian harassment and violence. These crimes have been so alarming that in his first week in office, President Biden signed an executive order asking the Justice Department to investigate. We're going to talk about this now with Mariah Balingit. She covers education for The Washington Post. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you reported in states like New York, Maryland, and Minnesota, where some schools are open. And what are they seeing with regards to Asian American students coming back?
Well, what's really interesting is that obviously Angelenos know that the Asian American community is super duper diverse. You have people living in poverty, you have people who are very wealthy, and you have people from South Asia, East Asia, Southeast Asia. This trend seems to cut across all of those groups, that Asian Americans are disproportionately making the decision to keep their children home. So in New York City at one point, Asian American parents were more likely to keep their kids home than even Black and Latino parents, who also have higher rates of keeping their children remote. So I thought that was really interesting. And we saw that in Virginia, in Minnesota, in the Hmong community. And it's interesting, too, to hear about it in Los Angeles.
And are the reasons the same? Do they cut across all of these different groups, or are they diverse as well?
Yeah, there are a variety of different reasons. And in some cases, they're largely the same as Black and Latino families. In other cases, they are distinct. When I spoke, for example, with a Chinese father in Maryland, he had been reading about the coronavirus since long before it arrived in the U.S. because he reads Chinese news sources. So he had a much better understanding of it, and he had a much greater fear of it, perhaps. But we're also hearing from some families who are worried about their children possibly facing anti-Asian harassment, not just in school, but on the way to school.
What do you mean on the way to school?
So on subways, on buses, that is where we're hearing a lot of the harassment is occurring. I spoke to a school principal who said a woman brought her child on the subway to school, and she was harassed on the train. And after that, she decided to keep her daughter home. She was afraid to ride the subway. You know, a school in Chinatown in New York City is probably majority Asian in many cases. So it's less of a fear of being taunted by classmates and more of a fear of what could happen on the way to school, just because we've seen some frightening incidents in which Asian Americans have been victimized.
You also write that there's concern for health-wise because more Asian American families live in multi-generational households than white families, for example. You write that 30% of Asians live in intergenerational households. And so are they afraid that if they send their kids to school, they might bring COVID back into the household?
Yeah, absolutely. We know that in a lot of Asian American families, you know, elderly parents are being cared for by children who might have children of their own. Sometimes you have cousins and aunts and uncles. So they would rather have the kids stay home than possibly expose an elderly person in the household to risk.
And then beyond their percentage in the population, many more Asians work in the healthcare field, either as doctors or nurses. So they have presumably seen this disease up close.
Right. I spoke to a Filipino nurse in New York City who actually was with a man when he passed away from coronavirus. She's an in-home nurse, and she had to spend a whole month away from her son while she recovered from coronavirus and also quarantined. And the idea of sending her son back to school, even though it's not optimal, was just too terrifying to her. She doesn't want to send her son back until he can get vaccinated, as well as all the teachers and his classmates.
What has been the response on the part of schools to all of this?
I think schools face a real dilemma here because they want to make sure that parents have the ability to choose what feels best for them. But there's basically a consensus that in-person schooling is superior to virtual learning in almost all cases. So a lot of schools are doing now is trying to regain trust among their parents, in some cases, which trust that has been lost because perhaps the school is under-resourced. In one case in Philadelphia, I spoke to a woman from China who told me that her son's school has had chronic problems with things like mold. And so she just doesn't trust that they're going to do a good job at ventilating the school, for example. So one thing that schools, I think, have to do and are working to do is installing the safeguards to ensure that school is safe, and then making parents feel comfortable with sending their kids back, explaining to them how it works, explaining to them how cohorting works and quarantining, and really helping them to understand what everything that the school is doing to keep their child safe.
And what about employing like anti-bullying messaging for the rest of the students?
Yeah, certainly. I think it's really critical that schools make very clear that bullying of any kind, and anti-Asian bullying, is unacceptable. I spoke to one woman who didn't end up making the story because she actually ended up sending her daughter back to school. But her daughter was taunted and called Corona by this group of boys who chanted Corona at her. And my heart really broke for this girl.
Yeah.
But she was really eager to go back to school. So they kept her home for a day. And they had a long talk with the principal about how to deal with this. The principal sent out a message, you know, condemning anti-Asian hate. They developed a program, an educational program around it. And the mother was happy to send her child back after that.
Wow. All the challenges that schools face. And also, I guess this could be a learning opportunity for everybody, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that the pandemic has exposed and has highlighted is just how important it is for schools to communicate with their parents and gain their parents' trust. And one of the things I've learned as a reporter is that it's not just safe to make the school safe. You have to also communicate how you're doing that and make kids and parents feel safe. Those are two sometimes separate and distinct missions. So I think, again, the pandemic has really exposed how important it is to maintain that relationship with parents.
Mariah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Mariah Balingit, she covers education for The Washington Post. Coming up, the small screen gets bigger. We'll talk about the expanding Marvel Cinematic Universe on TV next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, so that means it's time for TV on the Radio.
The crown has landed on my head.
Yes, queen, yeah.
You're not a killer.
This is the way.
You have to be a killer.
There was an offered before me.
If you're trying to curse, you can't.
That's bullshit.
We have so many disasters bombarding us right now.
Well, superhero movies have been big business for a while now. Take the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It has raked in tens of billions of dollars at the worldwide box office over the last, decade and a half. But as Marvel looks to life after 2019's Avengers Endgame and the other superhero stories it wants to tell, producers are looking to TV. Enter WandaVision on Disney Plus. The miniseries is about two secondary characters from the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Wanda and Vision.
This is our home now. I want us to fit in.
Oh, this is gonna be a gas!
Where did you two move from? How long have you been married, and why don't you have children yet?
WandaVision may have just wrapped, but it's paving the way for other Marvel superheroes to transition to TV. The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, Loki, Ms. Marvel and Hawkeye, all expected to have series streaming on Disney+. Joining us to talk about how the Marvel Cinematic Universe is expanding its storytelling is David Betancourt, comic culture reporter at The Washington Post. Hi, David.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks. And Woodrow Hood, director of film and media studies at Wake Forest University, where he teaches a course called Superheroes, Cinema, and American Mythology. Hi, Woody.
Hi there. Thanks for having us on.
Great to have you both. Well, let's begin with a clip from WandaVision. I want to play another clip. WandaVision is a 9-part miniseries, and one of the characters, Vision, is dead.
You're one of the Avengers. You're Vision. Are you here to help us?
I am Vision. I do want to help. But what's an Avenger?
What? Why don't you know? Am I dead?
No, no. Why would you think that?
Because you are.
Okay, so if people are not fully conversant in this, they are completely lost. David, what did we just hear, and what is WandaVision about?
Well, we were just listening to the very sly and sneaky Agatha. I'll keep it at that in case there are maybe 4 or 5 people listening that actually didn't watch the show, because it seemed like everyone was watching it. And that really kind of gives you a clue as to what this show is about, is people trying to figure out who they are, why they are, and where they are. It's a wild 9-part ride.
So it's in sitcoms, old sitcoms, or many of the episodes are set in old sitcoms. And why is that?
Well, and this is funny because the sitcoms both worked and didn't work. You know, I spoke to a lot of people who are my age, 80s babies, who grew up with the old sitcoms on Nick and Knight, as well as the 80s and 90s shows, and they loved every minute of it. And then there were some people that were kind of the hardcore Marvel Studios heads who were ready for the capes and the flying and the zapping and the destruction. The tone of the network sitcom, when we start in the 50s in the first episode, and then we get a new decade, it's like a 10-year jump each episode. It's really a reflection of Wanda's psyche and the one time in a life that was very war-torn at a very early age that she was happy. And that was when her family in Sokovia, which is a fictional European world in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, they would get together and they would watch American sitcoms and practice their English. And that was literally her little bit of happiness in her life before the death of her parents, before things changed for her forever. And she's using her grief as well as a very strong magical power to manipulate reality to turn her life into a sitcom.
Woody, for you, did that work for you? Did you like that way of telling the story? It's very meta.
It's super meta, and it did work for me, and I loved it, right? Having been sort of immersed in that media culture, you know, Dick Van Dyke, you know, on up through Malcolm in the Middle, and being a television and film person, I really loved them exploring these sitcom aesthetics through the decades, right? I think you make a really important point there at the beginning. If you're not kind of already in this, trying to sort of dig through all of those layers of understanding the background of the characters. And we do get some of that background as the episodes unfold, because we've never had a real good, clear origin story for Wanda. And we know from the comic books that she's the Scarlet Witch. She's one of the most powerful characters in the Marvel Universe, but they've never really developed her. They just sort of threw her in, knowing that, I guess, at some point, this would be the opportunity with WandaVision to really develop her character and give us some of her backstory. I think it's a clever way of doing it, right? Instead of just saying, okay, she's born in Sokovia and she grew up, we have this lens of her grief and her traumas throughout the years kind of unfolding in this fantasy sitcom overlay.
And so is that it, though, for them, David? There's no more Wanda and the Vision?
Well, for those of us who have to follow this very tightly, and I'm one of those people, although I would honestly be one of those people even if I didn't have the job that I have, we are going to see Wanda again in the sequel to Doctor Strange, which is called Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. We get some hints and name drops to Doctor Strange when Agatha tells Wanda, you know, you're more powerful than the Sorcerer Supreme. That's Doctor Strange. The post-credit scene where Wanda is seemingly in two places and once in a cabin, that's a sorcery trick. She is studying the Book of Darkhold, that dark book of magic that made an appearance in the final episode. So WandaVision may possibly be done. And even if they decide to bring them back in another series, it might not be called WandaVision. But Wanda's not going anywhere because she is going to be a big part of the Doctor Strange sequel.
Okay, well, phew, because I really liked her character. So let's move on to the next Marvel TV series coming to Disney+. It's The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, and it debuts on Friday. Anthony Mackie is returning as Falcon, Sebastian Stan returning as Winter. Here's a clip.
These guys use brute force. They're strong.
Too strong.
And they might be a part of the big three.
What big three?
Androids, aliens, and wizards.
That's not a thing.
That's definitely a thing.
No, it's not. There are no wizards.
Dr. Strange
is a sorcerer.
A sorcerer is a wizard without a hat.
Okay, so Woody, these are familiar characters now, and this is more kind of what we're used to when we talk about Marvel. What are you expecting from this series?
It is. I actually like that you pulled that trailer clip for a couple of different reasons. So this is going to take place after the last big blockbuster movie. Captain America is stepping down. He is passing on his shield to somebody else. This is sort of about Mackie's character trying to come to, we assume, we haven't seen it yet, but to come to grips with taking on the mantle of Captain America, right, and all of the weight of that. We'll see how this unfolds, but it seems like the focus is going to be on Mackie's character and the fact that we're moving towards a Black man playing Captain America and what that means. The guy who's the writer on this, Malcolm Spellman, this is the person behind Empire and Hip Hop Uncovered. And I'm really excited to see kind of where he takes this, because I think there's a lot of real potential in exploring race through the lens of Captain America, particularly right now.
Right. And so, David, how forcefully and interestingly will Disney take that on? I mean, it's still Disney after all.
This is Disney, and this would represent, obviously, Black Panther was a cultural event, first lead Black superhero at Marvel. He's the what many consider to be the greatest Black superhero of all time. And the movie made $1 billion. But this is not Disney and Marvel, you know, basking in the wokeness of the era. This is a storyline that actually happened in the comics. And there are two storylines that many people think this series will be based on. One is the most recent Captain America series from a few years ago, where the Falcon did assume the mantle of Captain America because Captain America asked him to. And it dealt with an America not really being ready for that. It was very much parallel to the reaction to Barack Obama being elected president of the United States, first Black president of the United States, where you had some people that were very excited about Sam Wilson being Captain America, a Black man. And you had some people that said, well, that's not my Captain America. There's another series, and this is the one that we don't know and we'll have to watch. We know that this series is going to delve into Anthony Mackie's character struggling with whether he can handle the responsibility that Steve Rogers has given him, basically giving him that shield. But another Marvel series that came out in the early 2000s is called Truth, Red, White, and Black. And that comic book series actually revealed that the first Captain America was a Black man. Steve Rogers was able to receive the super soldier serum that turned him into basically a superpowered super athlete being, because they did multiple experiments on black soldiers to try and get it right. There was a lot of tragedy in those experiments, but the one thing that came out of it was the first man to be Captain America was a black man. But, you know, in the Marvel universe, the way the story was told, that is an urban legend that the general public doesn't really know. And it will be very interesting to see, because it's already enough taking on Captain America and race with the Falcon possibly taking on the mantle. It's another thing to take on that true storyline too, because if they did both of those in one series, that would be pretty heavy.
Yeah, absolutely. And what year did that happen? When was that written into the comic book?
Between 2003, 2005. I don't have it off the top of my head, but it was very early 2000s. You know, there have been efforts over the last 5-10 years. I would say since the creation of Miles Morales in 2011, the half Puerto Rican, half African-American Spider-Man, a character I take a strong liking to because that's the exact racial background that I am.
Are you Miles? I mean, you do write for a newspaper, so you could be Clark Kent. I don't know.
I actually, Brian Michael Bendis, who's the co-creator of Miles, when I was interviewing him years ago when Miles first came out, I told him my racial background, and he said, "Oh, you are Miles." That still ranks as one of my coolest comic book moments. But I will say that since Miles debuted in the comics, and obviously he's been a part of an Academy Award winning animated film, Into the Spider-Verse, you know, Miles is very mainstream now. But there have been efforts in the comic book industry at all the major publishers, Marvel, DC, Image, you name it, to get more diverse, not just with the characters on the page, but the writers and artists responsible for bringing those stories together. When Truth came out, the comic book industry was not having that conversation yet. So it really was very impactful because it just was not the type of story you were used to being told.
Woody, I just want to ask sort of a bigger picture question about what's happening just financially for Marvel, for Disney, and for movies versus TV. Obviously, we're watching these shows on TV in part because, well, we can't go to the movie theaters. Is this going to be a permanent shift, do you think?
Right. Yes, it has to be in some ways, right? I think the shift has been kind of coming for a while. I think in a way the COVID really sort of sped it up in some way. So now we've got this kind of simultaneous release, right? I can go and see the new Wonder Woman at the theater if I'm vaccinated or if I don't care, or I can sit at home safely with my family and all the kids, and it's a lot cheaper for me. I think it's an interesting business model because they're trying to figure out how to hit both of those markets. I think, as always, if the studios could have cut out the cinemas and gone directly to the consumer, of course, they would have always taken that option. I mean, I think we've seen that over the past few years, that these big media companies sort of making these partnerships with studio, right? We've got the Marvel, Disney kind of owns most of everything now, right? But then Warner Brothers, right, decided to go directly to streaming for their films this year. That's going to be really hard to pull back on. So I think we're going to have to see, and I don't have a crystal ball, I could be totally wrong, but this idea of sort of the event movie, which is really what Infinity Wars, that's what Endgame, right? Everybody had to go and see it. I had to go see it in that first week or so. The same thing with Black Panther, because I want to know what's happening in it before I, you know, hear the spoilers, before it's kind of ruined for me. I have to be part of that event. How they're going to sort of hit those people is going to be interesting. I'm not sure if the Cineplex, the Megaplex, is going to really survive. I know the ones in my town are ready to shutter, I think. But this idea for the event movie, which is what Marvel has always kind of built up to, right? So all these TV series, the standalones are always trying to build to that big mega $1 billion win for Marvel.
All right. Well, in the meantime, we have a lot of good TV to watch. So anyway, that's okay by me. Well, thank you both so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you. It was fun.
Thank you for having us.
Winnie Hood is director of film and media studies at Wake Forest University. David Betancourt, comic culture reporter at The Washington Post. All right. Don't forget you can download or subscribe to our podcast and listen whenever, wherever you want. It's at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.